Welcome to The Source. I'm Paul Flav, in for David Martin Davies. It's cold outside by San Antonio standards, and with the cold oftentimes means beds for the homeless population quickly fill up at San Antonio shelters. According to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, 1 million Americans access their homeless prevention programs, and there were 610,000 homeless people in America at the beginning of 2013. 150,000 of those individuals were mentally ill. We're talking about the mentally ill living on the streets today. Oftentimes, we want to help. We know in our heads that they are people in need, but just as often, we're unable to get past our own fears, our own preconceived notions based on their tattered clothes, unusual behavior, or just aggressive panhandling. A natural reaction for us to avoid the people we don't understand, but as our guests will point out, when we avoid human interaction, we begin to stop thinking of the homeless, especially the mentally ill homeless, as people. Dr. Robert Okun was chief of psychiatry at San Francisco General. Dr. Okun was so interested in the mentally ill homeless, he took 2 years meeting with and speaking with these individuals. He's recently published a book of photographs and of interviews with the mentally ill homeless, along with some of those interviews. Dr. Okun, welcome to The Source.
Thanks so much.
So this is a community conversation about our community and America in general. Have you been homeless? Do you struggle with mental illness or addiction? Or have you worked with this group of people? Give us a call. We want to hear from you. 210-614-8980 is our phone number. Or email us questions at thesource@tpr.org. Dr. Okun, your book came out in October. It's called Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street. And it's a book of photography of people living on the streets, primarily in San Francisco, where you live, paired with short excerpts from what I imagine were long conversations at times. Is that about right?
Yes, exactly.
And when you heard my introduction, did that sound accurate? When we think about the homeless and the mentally ill homeless, we get it in our heads, but we don't get it elsewhere.
Yeah, that's right. The way I got really involved in this and decided to write a book about it was this. One night in San Francisco, it was winter and cold and wet, and I was hurrying to get out of the rain, and as I stepped into my car, I saw a homeless woman lying on the sidewalk, completely drenched. For days afterwards, I just couldn't get her out of my mind. I couldn't fathom how in the world she managed that night and the next day and the next night, wet and cold and really no place to go. I just couldn't figure out how she could stand it. So I decided I was going to spend a couple of years on the street half time, talking to people, finding out how they managed, what their challenges were, and how they became homeless, and why it seemed so impossible to climb out of homelessness. And that's what I did.
So you just told us how this came to be, crystallized your desire to do this book. Is your attempt at doing this book not only to find out how they managed, but also to give a human face and to remind people that they are human?
Yeah. Yeah, once I began to talk to them, I realized that their stories were just so compelling that I just needed to share them with a wider audience, because it was clear to me in virtually all the work I've done in the public sector that the major challenge to getting services to people who are severely mentally ill is that they're so stigmatized that people can't identify with them. And that gets translated into the ballot box as lack of support for what they need: homes, case management, vocational services. So I wanted to try to destigmatize this population, to give them, as you say, a human face, so that people would connect with them. And I thought, if they connected with them and identified with their predicaments, that they might offer them more understanding and less blame, and that they might be willing to share with them rather than ignoring them or withhold from them.
I've heard you talk about those first incidences of going out to try and talk to talk to people about their lives, to have them tell you their stories and actually be able to take photographs of them. And it sounded like it was a real dynamic shift for you as someone who's worked in psychiatry for 40 years. What was it like to now not have the power in the conversation?
Right. That's exactly what it was. I had nothing. So I thought I had nothing to offer them. And yet I was asking them to reveal the most intimate aspects of their lives to me. I had no power. I was just kind of a doctor on the street. And it was like there was a role reversal between us. Instead of me having something to give them, you know, as when they came to the hospital or my office, now they had something that I needed and that they could withhold from me. It was like I had the tin cup rather than them, and it made me very anxious. I thought that they would just spurn me and turn me down and basically push me away emotionally.
But that's not what you found.
No, it's not what I found, and I was surprised after a number of days that they, in fact, by and large, were very welcoming. About 70% of them, of the people I approached, were willing to talk to me, were willing to have me record their stories, as they told me, and were willing to let me photograph them. And surprisingly, they didn't just talk to me superficially or defensively. They really talked to me in a rather intimate way, revealing things in their lives that they had a lot of feeling about. That was the other thing I was really surprised about. Not only were they welcoming rather than rejecting, but their feelings were so close to the surface. All it took was a couple of questions often to bring tears to their eyes and for them to tell me things that they hadn't talked about for years.
And why photography?
Well, I didn't start out thinking I would photograph people, but as they talked to me about their lives, I was struck with how beautiful and how expressive their faces were. And I wanted to convey that to the reader as well, hoping that they would, you know, if they flipped through the book, as people often do when they're deciding whether or not to buy a book, as they flipped through the book, I was hoping that they would be struck by the beauty and humanity of these people's faces and then be drawn into their stories.
Putting a human face back on the mentally ill homeless, reminding us that these people are, in fact, people. The book Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street, is what we're talking about with Dr. Robert Okun. What's your experience with the mentally ill on the street or with the homeless? Have you been homeless? Give us a call. Tell us your story, 210-614-8980. We're going to take a quick break here on The Source. We'll be back in 1 minute. Welcome back to The Source. I'm Paul Flab, in for David Martin Davies. We're talking to Dr. Robert Okun about his book, Silent Voices. It's a beautiful book of photographs and excerpts from interviews with the mentally ill homeless people he came to know, forged relationships with in San Francisco. And we're talking about the odds for mentally ill homeless, how they manage their lives, how they get off the streets, if they get off the streets, which... let's be honest, the odds are stacked against them. Dr. Okun, before we left, we were talking about the book, but let's talk about some of the folks you did forge relationships with. I'm looking at the book now. There's a woman named Rebecca. Can you talk about how you met her and what her story is?
Yeah, Rebecca was actually referred to me by her social worker. And Rebecca had been on the street. She had had bipolar disorder and actually lived on the street part of the time and lived in a bus that went from San Francisco to, I can't remember where now, Salt Lake City or someplace far away. And she went back and forth in the bus, and that's how she took shelter. When I asked her, what her early life had been, it was just the story of neglect and abuse. She had been allowed to burn herself. She, as a child of about 3 or 4 years old, on a hot radiator, she had broken her arm. Basically, her mother had allowed her to put herself in very risky situations. And then, when she was a little older, about 8 or 9, her stepfather raped her so violently that he tore her, and she needed to be hospitalized and sewn up. He only got a year in jail for it, believe it or not. And she just continued to have a terrible, terrible childhood.
But she was functional for a long period of time. It sounded like there was a stretch,
yes.
and it was a series of further traumatic incidents and bad luck that led her to the streets.
Yes, that's right. She managed to overcome all of that trauma that I just described, and she worked for many years and was quite prized at her work. But then there were a series of incidents, including a very bad accident, that seemed to revive all the trauma of her childhood, and she was afflicted by all kinds of memories and flashbacks, and the experience seemed to trigger the onset of this bipolar disorder.
And that seemed to be a parallel with a number of people in the book, early sexual trauma and then incidents later on that would reawaken them and cause all kinds of mental health issues in their present day. Were you surprised at how willing to talk about these things they were, and B, how often sexual violence was involved in their lives?
Yeah, I was surprised at how many of the women were willing to tell me that they had been sexually abused. Over 40% were willing to talk about it, and they didn't talk about it easily. They talked about it with a lot of shame and a lot of obvious discomfort. So it was clear that the violence that they had experienced in their childhood were still living with them in a very real kind of way.
I want to be sure to mention that you did make it clear what the purpose of these interviews were for. You got permission, and the profits do go towards homeless advocacy groups. How did you deal with it ethically, morally, with yourself? Because I think that there is a feeling when you do a project like that, this with the best of intentions, there's some internal struggle.
Yeah. Well, I think in addition to being afraid that people would, not be welcoming, I was also afraid of some of the conflicts that I had about doing it. Even though my intent was positive and caring, I was worried that there was some shadow part of myself that was, kind of voyeuristic, and or at least that I would be seen that way. And I had to really be, I don't know, open and honest with myself about at least what the majority of my intent was in doing this. And it wasn't until I realized that people were getting something out of these interviews. It wasn't just that they were giving me something, but they were clearly getting something from it. Most of these people had been ignored as children and neglected, in addition to being abused. Although I want to come back to that, because that doesn't cover the entire population by any means. But most of the people I talked to had been neglected as children, and they felt absolutely voiceless. And of course, in their homeless state, people turn away from them and ignore them, and they're voiceless, which is why I called my book Silent Voices. And many of them wanted to tell their stories and wanted to tell their stories publicly. It counteracted their sense of voicelessness. And I think for many people, telling their stories was a way of doing something constructive in the world, because many of them came to feel themselves as screw-ups and
powerless, it sounds like.
And powerless.
We want to make sure to make some time for folks that want to tell their stories here on The Source as well. James has called in. He called 210-614-8980. James, you're on the line. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Paul. Thank you for having me.
What did you want to say today?
Well, I was just intrigued by the subject matter, I guess, having experienced that myself and having lived with a mental disorder and with a series of events that led up to my being homeless and to not really fitting the homeless stereotype, because as a homeless person with a lot of the same issues that you're describing now, I somehow still managed to function through the homelessness as the person who was able to work and do a lot of things in society that maybe people don't typically expect homeless people to do. I think if there's one message I felt compelled to leave listeners with, is that there are a lot more of us out among the general population than people realize. And homelessness does not always mean joblessness. It always doesn't mean that the person is totally non-functioning in society. I managed to work two jobs the entire time I was homeless, and nobody knew. People were none the wiser, and I developed my own method of being able to get food and to keep clean and wash my clothing. And so it's not as simple as someone who looks, sounds, or acts homeless. It's something much bigger than people can fathom, I think.
James, thanks so much for your story. It sounds like it took not only a lot to maintain the jobs, but it took a lot to maintain this idea that you were not homeless to the people you were with, because I would assume you wanted to disguise that. Is that true?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last part.
Oh, I was just saying, were you intentionally trying to disguise the fact that you were homeless because you feared that you might lose a job?
Oh, absolutely. No, I didn't want anyone to know. Nobody wants anyone to know that. You know, and you certainly don't want to believe it. You just... It was a very taxing thing psychologically to understand that you were without a home, you were without a place to call yours, and so you essentially go into a type of survival mode where you strip yourself down to the very basic food, clothing, shelter. You find your ways to get shelter even though you don't have a place of your own to call home, and you find yourself looking at the world completely different, because we have it great in this country. I never had to rummage through garbage cans. I never had to beg for food, and we throw away more food in this country than I never had to go through garbage. I mean, I could walk through a restaurant and find food that people had left in to-go boxes, and it totally untouched, not even, I mean,
right.
It was just a really eye-opening experience. And
James, you are housed now?
I'm fully employed. Answer your question, I have my own place. I'm not housed through any type of assistance.
Right. Well, congratulations. Thanks so much for calling in. We want to let Robert take it from there. Robert, a lot of things packed into that that statement from James. We've got stigma. We've got him reminding us that it does not look like one thing. You want to take it from there?
Yeah. First of all, I just want to say how impressive I think James is. He's impressive, he's unusual, and he was incredibly ingenious and creative in the way he dealt with what was clearly an incredibly demoralizing situation. He managed to keep not just one job, but two jobs. It's just really impressive. I think, as I said, I think he's unusual in several ways. One was that he didn't accept the identity of homelessness. He didn't equate himself with being homeless. He thought of himself as someone without a home, but he didn't identify himself that way. And in fact, he took pains to show himself to the world in a very opposite way. That's the first thing. The second way that he was really unusual was in being able to maintain a job. Homelessness makes it so difficult for people to both get a job and keep a job that it's unusual when someone does it. I mean, for one thing, James figured out a way of keeping his clothes presentable and washing and showering and so on and so forth. Most homeless people just don't have the resources to do that. I mean, some combination of the emotional and functional resources to do that. So they really don't know how to walk into a prospective job and ask for it and compete for it, and they have a cart that they're lugging around. And
right,
they
right. There's so
that.
Many different ways we don't realize how it impacts your life until you're in the situation. We're talking with Dr. Robert Okun about his new book, Silent Voices. We'll be back after a break with NPR News. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Paul Flav, in for David Martin Davies. We're talking with Dr. Robert Okun about his new book of photography and interviews called Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street. Okun's former chief of psychiatry at San Francisco General Hospital. He was also commissioner of mental health for the states of Vermont and Massachusetts. I want to talk with you, Dr. Okun, about maybe some causes or maybe get your opinion on what other people have called causes, namely deinstitutionalization. Institutionalization happened in the 80s, and what did you think of that? Is that what you believe caused the kind of crisis-like numbers we're seeing in homelessness today?
Well, I think there are actually several factors. One factor was the deinstitutionalization, the release of people from the institution without services, clearly set the stage for homelessness. There were, in the 60s, 550,000 mentally ill people in mental hospitals, and now there are about 40,000. So people were just dumped without services. There was a promise there would be services, but those promises were never really fulfilled. So that's one reason. The second reason is that there's a lack of affordable housing in many cities and a lack of case management. Clearly, housing, low-cost housing, and case management represent the two solutions to homelessness. A third problem was a welfare system that keeps people in poverty and forces them often to choose between miserable housing and other needs. And then there's the symptoms of certain mental illnesses and the inability of many people to tolerate the side effects of their psychiatric medication. And then there's the substance abuse epidemic, and that really changed the face of mental illness in the United States and also helped set the stage for homelessness. And then there's the pressure that's being placed on hospitals by insurance companies and state and federal governments to discharge mentally ill people much too early from their psychiatric wards.
Which is really just shifting the costs. But we'll get into that in a minute. I did want to get to an email we got from Bonnie. These discussions always seem to draw an artificial line between the mentally ill and the addict slash alcoholics. Addiction itself is a mental illness recognized as such by medical authorities and researchers. Did you want to address that?
I think the caller is absolutely right. I think substance abuse is a kind of mental disorder, a mental disorder that people who have it tend to be blamed for, but it is a mental disorder.
And oftentimes with the folks that have experienced extreme trauma, it's delved into to address, you know, the self-medicate the problems that they have.
Well, that's right. In fact, a lot of the people who I spoke about before who were abused and neglected as children turned to drugs in their adolescence to try to medicate their pain, and that only caused them more problems, and they entered adulthood with no employable skills and a substance abuse problem. And for many of them, homelessness was kind of an inevitability.
You write in your book about the trend of how we treat the homeless, going from small, focused hospitals to these large psychiatric institutions. Texas itself still has 9 of these institutions, and mental health is a huge issue in Texas. The spending on it's very low. I think we still managed to serve 22,000 people in 2013 is what I read. But the system's been given scathing reviews time after time. How do we address mental health in a large system with people that may not be able to navigate those systems?
Well, I think, you know, institutionalization, homelessness, and jails and prisons are, generally speaking, 3 really bad responses to mental illness, and yet those are 3 very common responses. People who are mentally ill need some basic things. They need housing. They need case management. They need psychiatric and vocational services. And the state has to put up the money to provide those services. And if it doesn't, what the states are going to find is that a lot of people will have to remain in mental hospitals, other people will be homeless, and still other people who are mentally ill will be criminalized.
Well, criminalization of the homeless population is something that is addressed time and again. Cities across the country who want to maybe push the problem out of its center cities. San Antonio has several very strict ordinances about panhandling, about loitering. Recently, they tried to pass an ordinance that would make it illegal to give food and money to the homeless. Have you seen laws like that passed in other cities? They failed to pass here, but what have been the consequences of stricter ordinances like that?
Well, the consequences are that people who are homeless and mentally ill are pushed into jails and prisons for crimes that the state or the city sets them up for. And the result is that their mental illness in the context of the jail and prison often gets aggravated because frequently they're not really treated properly. And when their sentences are up, they get dumped back into the street with only $50 in their pocket, a change of clothes and no place to go, no housing, no link to services, nothing. They're poorer and more symptomatic after their incarceration than before, and it just becomes a vicious cycle of homelessness, jail, homelessness, maybe a hospitalization, homelessness. It's not a solution to the problem. It's just pushing the problem from one place to another.
Right now in Texas, Harris County Jail, it said, is the largest psychiatric provider of psychiatric services in the state. I'm interested in what the cost of that looks like when you see it shifted from the hospital to the jail. What does it look like?
Well, the same thing is true in California, by the way. the Los Angeles County Jail is the largest provider of mental health. Well, it has the most mentally ill people in it, let me put it that way, of any institution in the state. And it needs to be realized that imprisonment is an expensive proposition. You know, in California, it's been estimated that it costs about $60,000 a year to imprison someone. And I don't think that includes all the what you might call the processing costs, you know, the police, the court system, the parole system, the probation system. So it's an expensive non-solution to the problem.
We're talking with Dr. Robert Okun about his new book, Silent Voices. We're going to be back in a minute here on Texas Public Radio. We're going to talk to another group of folks that have done a similar project at UTSA. We'll be talking to them about a book that they've recently completed and will be selling to support homeless advocacy or homeless services here in Texas. We're going to take a quick break. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 210-614-8980. Mental illness and the homeless population is what we're talking about. Or shoot us an email at thesource@tpr.org. Back after this. Welcome back to The Source. I'm Paul Flav. We're talking about mental illness in the homeless population. We're talking with Dr. Robert Okun, former chief of psychiatry at San Francisco General Hospital. I want to bring in now Drew Redding. Drew's a student in social work at the University of Texas, San Antonio. Drew and his classmates, 30 of them, have collaborated with the Center of Healthcare Services to work on a project much like Dr. Okun's called My Journey Through Homelessness. Drew, welcome to the program.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Drew, tell us what exactly you were doing with this project, what you interviewed homeless folks that were in services with the Center for Healthcare Services. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And tell us what the outcome was. What do you have here? What would we read if we were to read this book?
So I'm just amazed at how much our project echoes the work that Dr. Okun has done and the book that he's developed. So what we have are, you know, stories that include people who are veterans or suburban moms or recently arrived immigrants. And it shows the strength and resilience of them as they've gone through some extremely difficult circumstances.
And in your work with these folks, what did you expect and what did you find? What surprised you about working with the mentally ill? You're a social work student. Obviously, you're not a professional social worker yet. So what were you expecting?
Right. I've personally had experience working with those who are homeless in the past, while other classmates had not. And so they definitely had an eye-opening experience where they might have held some of the same misconceptions that the general public had. And then personally, I found some of their stories to be not ones you would expect to find.
Like what?
So one in particular was a man named Darren who went to UT. He graduated with a college degree and spent 20 years teaching high school and middle school music classes. And, you know, after those 20 years, he had to resign to take care of his parents. And when they passed, he began experiencing depression, which led to some debt, and he just couldn't find the help he needed. And so at 56, he found himself homeless, seeking these same services that people who are 18 or 20 are also looking for.
Now, Drew, when you went to work with these folks, what surprised you other than some of their stories, like the one you just noted? Was there anything out there that you just were shocked by?
I don't think I was really shocked by anything that we were told. We have spent our class has spent a few years kind of listening to some of these stories about mental health, and we were really prepared to work with this type of population. We might have been surprised and shocked to see how little services they are receiving now that we are out there in this organization.
And when you, Dr. Robert Okun, when you hear people like Drew talking about their studies and this is the field they've chosen, what do you think about when you're thinking about your work?
Well, I think, first of all, that Drew makes a really good point, that the people who become homeless are a very diverse group of people. People who are mentally ill and homeless are diverse. Most of the people I spoke to had come from the backgrounds that I described, basically neglectful and abusive. But this is really important. There are many mentally ill people who came from backgrounds that were incredibly loving and supportive, from families who did everything they could to try to help them, and who have fought alongside of them all of their lives. And these families are incredibly brave and courageous. And one of the reasons that we have some of the services we do today is because of the advocacy of these families. So it's really important for people to recognize that it's not just abuse and neglect that creates, what we see on the streets. Mental illness and the biological vulnerability to mental illness is also a major factor.
And in talking with Drew and yourself, what is it about homelessness that you think is the most traumatic for people? Is it a case where people are traumatized and they end up on the streets, or they're on the streets and they become traumatized? What is it after they become homeless that makes it so much more difficult to come out of it? Dr. Okun, and then maybe Drew, if you have any thoughts on it, you're welcome to as well.
Well, being on the street day after day, night after night, in all kinds of weather, exposed to the violence of the street and the instability and insecurity of the street itself is so disorganizing and disorienting that it's difficult for many mentally ill homeless people to climb out of that. For one thing, they can't hold on to their medications, which are either lost or stolen. They can't stabilize themselves. They're psychologically disoriented. Homelessness is physically very traumatic to the body. Many people lose their teeth and become infected and have pneumonia and cardiac problems. Homelessness affects every single part of the person.
And Drew, any thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think that being homeless is just inherently dangerous. Living on the streets, you are very vulnerable, especially while you're sleeping. It's not uncommon for a homeless person to be assaulted without really any true reason or provocation. And another aspect, I think, is they're kind of living outside of society. They're not really being inclusive of what we would have in our everyday lives, and they might feel like they're just disappearing.
I think Drew makes a very good point. People on the street, in addition to their psychological and the psychological and physical trauma, just feel pushed to the margins of society. They feel like they're just non-people, and that's unfortunately how we as a society have treated them, as non-people.
We're talking with Dr. Robert Okun, former chief of psychiatry at San Francisco General Hospital, and Drew Redding, about mentally ill homelessness, the challenges therein. The title of your book, Drew, you and your collaborators, your student collaborators, is My Journey Through Homelessness. What were some of the outcomes for the folks that contributed to this book?
All of the members currently are in the program still. They're still going through some classes. They're getting case management and looking to find some stable housing and a long-term job. So they're still trying to find their outcomes at the moment.
But they're in progress, but they are making progress. Is that accurate?
That's definitely true.
And Dr. Robert Okun, is there any person in your book that you would want to single out as someone who had actually defied the odds, had made progress, and was trying to get his situation, his or her situation, together?
Yes, Jeff, who had a schizophrenic mother who he was afraid would knife him in his sleep, somehow managed to transcend that, and he became a garbage collector, but he at one point had some pot detected in his urine. He was fired. He became depressed and treated himself, so to speak, with street drugs. He was on the street for 10 years, and with the help of a case manager, was able to find housing and is now working half-time.
I want to go into some of the statistics we've seen in the last 3 years. It seems like there has been some progress on this front. I'm looking at HUD data for 2013. Number of individuals experiencing chronic homelessness declined by 16% in the general group of homeless population, and amongst veterans had declined even further. Are we making progress in your mind, Dr. Okun?
I think these figures show that we are making progress, and what they also show is that this is not an unsolvable problem. This is a problem that when governments decide they're going to do something about, they can do something about the problem. Now, clearly, not enough has been done, but I think the progress that has been made shows that homelessness is not a fact of American life, or if it is now, it doesn't have to be.
We've only got a few seconds left. Can you talk about any one strategy that you see working?
Yes, there's a strategy called Housing First that I think is a fundamental solution to the homelessness problem. Housing First is a kind of common sense strategy that says that we're going to provide housing and not require that people meet some kind of artificial preconditions. They don't have to get cleaned up. They don't have to take their psychiatric medication. Give them housing and clinical support, and they're much more likely to be able to get off drugs and take their psychiatric medications.
Obviously very controversial in the places it's been proposed, just because people don't like to hear that these kinds of housing options are available when it comes on the public's dime. They think they call it paying for other people to get drunk, things like that. Very cynical points of view on it. I was just wondering what do the rates of success look like? What are the outcomes of those strategies?
Well, Utah has used this approach, and it's used it for almost 8 to 10 years. About 80 to 85% of the people who they housed have remained housed. And it was expected, by other people that this would fail and that people would kind of blow out of their housing because their symptoms hadn't been treated first. What was found is if you give them housing, people are much more likely to allow themselves to be treated.
Housing First strategy may be a way of tackling this. We are out of time, unfortunately. Dr. Robert Okun, thank you so much. Your book, Silent Voices, is out now, and Drew Redding, your book is called My Journey Through Homelessness. Details a lot of different homeless folks' stories of homeless trying to get their stories out to the public. We are out of time. My name is Paul Flav. This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks, Robert and Drew, for joining us.
Thank you.
Have a good one.